Hi, friends. I'm Pearson Cross. I'm the host of Bayou de Beltway. Today, we are joined by two eminent scholars to talk about critical race theory, which is the topic du jour among many dinner tables, conversations, as well as in the newspapers being jousted about daily on websites and on news programs. To help us understand this issue, we are joined by Dr. Albert Samuels, who is chair of the Department of Political Science and Geography at Southern University, where he's been since 1999. He teaches black politics, voting rights, and American political development. We are also joined by Dr. Theodore Roosevelt Foster III, who got a bachelor's at UAB, a master's at Ohio State, and then moved on to get his PhD at Northwestern in Chicago. He studies civil rights history and black politics, and he's been at UL Lafayette since 2019. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, as you know, there's a great deal of controversy right now surrounding this idea of critical race theory. It seems to have been a real cause célèbre on the right. So a lot of people are probably scratching their heads, and including some people I know, saying, where did critical race theory come from and why is it so controversial? Who would like to start?
Well, I'd like to jump in.
Dr. Samuels?
Yes. Critical race theory actually emerged out of law school, specifically Harvard Law School, in late 1970s, early 80s. Actually, it really grew out of critical legal studies. But what the real genesis of this was scholars who, in reaction to the civil rights movement and some of the landmark civil rights legislation that came about as a result of this, we're noticing that despite of the fact that we have all these new laws, that structural patterns of any racial inequality remain stubbornly resilient. And so trying to understand that using the law as a mechanism for understanding its role in maintaining racial hierarchy is really what critical race theory is really about. It's understanding the way in which law has supported our system of racial subordination really from colonial days up to now. That's in essence what critical race theory is.
Excellent. Dr. Foster, you want to add to that?
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Samuels. I think that was a really helpful introduction. And thank you, Pearson, for, again, the invitation. Dr. Samuels left off saying, from colonial times to now, which is a broad 500 years swath of time, to consider how race was constructed. Now, critical race theory is focused on how race is constructed in the law. As a black studies scholar, we know that race is constructed in so many other areas than simply the law or politics or literature, etc. But it's important to understand the post-civil rights, post-60s kind of moment in which these black legal scholars like Derrick Bell, the first tenured black professor at Harvard, found themselves in, wrestling with the supposed gains of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and other flagship legal decisions during the modern civil rights movement had yet to, in the 1970s, 80s, pan out in the way that commentators, politicians had celebrated, right, the victories of the civil rights movement as the legal gains. And certainly, I don't want to diminish the role of the Voting Rights Act of 65 in really enforcing what should have always been a given in the U.S. that has never been a given in the U.S. that one person has the right. Every person, every citizen has the right to vote. And so I think it's really important to think about these quote unquote black firsts who are entering kind of new levels of inclusion in the legal profession, who are challenging the establishment to say, wait a minute. If at one point black people were rendered property legally under the law, and property law was developed through black bodies, we need to consider the legacy and remnants of that beyond just the legal victories of the civil rights movement, that there needs to be more reform to the law. So I would describe a CRT, critical race theory, as a deeply patriotic project that seeks to reform the law and make the Constitution truly applicable to all.
There's some interesting things in there. One, you describe critical race theory as deeply patriotic. And in fact, let's address that directly, because that's a little bit of I hesitate to use this, but the elephant in the room. And that is that, people are saying, no, it's critical race theory is unpatriotic and seeks to attack the foundations of our society by suggesting that Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln and those people were maybe less than the kind of people that we would have thought they were, that they in fact supported an unequal society. So how would you respond, or how do you justify saying, no, it's deeply patriotic to engage in critical race theory?
I think that's in many ways, that's a canard. Because basically every time historically, and I know Dr. Foster can probably add some other examples of this, but almost every time that black people have challenged racial hierarchy in America, their patriotism has been questioned. Frederick Douglass was Frederick Douglass. You know, his patriotism, was questioned. And when he said, what does the 4th of July mean to me? And oftentimes what all black people have been saying is that your great pronouncements in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, that those things should also apply to us as well. It's what David Walker said in 1829 in the appeal, which is sort of a rebuttal to Thomas Jefferson's, in many ways, the notes from the state of Virginia. Are we not men? Because if we are, then we are also definitely entitled to these rights. And so this notion that critical race theory is unpatriotic is really symptomatic of really the larger pushback against really every attempt by black people. And also the whites who have been sympathetic to the causes of black people, who have challenged racial hierarchy. So I just think this is just a continuation of that. Now, it's the idea that the notion of racial hierarchy is so embedded in America that anytime it's challenged, it is viewed as an attack on America itself. I think that's what this challenge this patriotism is really about.
Interesting. Dr. Foster, you want to add something there?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree in terms of the backlash and really trying to think about the long durée of this backlash, or we might say, as Van Jones said after the election of Trump, a kind of white lash. After Reconstruction, we have Jim Crow. After civil rights, we have color blindness as a kind of post-civil rights strategy, not only on the right, but also the left, to take race, slavery, reparations off the table, which also takes off the table any understanding of white racial identity as ever benefiting, or at least since the 1960s, from any kind of legacy or history or connection to white supremacist exploitation and domination. So, you know, I agree that it's a kind of canard. Like, in many ways, the discussion about critical race theory, the question, you know, what is critical race theory, is a response to a racist presumption that critical race theory in and of itself is producing, quote unquote, reverse racism, which is another myth created by the right in an effort to, again, take acknowledgement, recognition, and the key part for me as an educator is teaching about Black history, racism, et cetera, off the table. And I think the uprisings of 2020 after George Floyd's viral killing was broadcast, recentered Black protest that is still in this moment and back in June of 2020 being criminalized. We have to connect the, you know, op-ed that Senator from Arkansas Tom Cotton wrote with the New York Times, and the New York Times said they shouldn't have published it. He said to send in the troops, right? Send in the troops to Black protesters in cities uprising after this killing. It's a similar kind of law and order rhetoric that was used in the 1960s to render, in the case of certain protests in the 60s, right, nonviolent protests as a riot, disorder, in need of law enforcement to, quote, bust heads. You know, the former president definitely used that rhetoric explicitly. So I think, you know, to connect that to contemporary legislation that Senator Cotton has also proposed to remove the 1619 Project, you know, it's an ongoing post-Obama, you know, kind of backlash, too, that we don't want to center Black history. We don't want to center slavery. We don't want to center racism. We are in a post-racial moment that is free from those issues. So to bring it up is divisive in and of itself. Right.
Yeah, there's a real it's odd the way this keeps coming back, but, it comes back for certain reasons. In a previous comment, you were going down and you were talking about the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And I was just thinking, yeah, the Supreme Court just basically said, okay, the Voting Rights Act, at least significant parts involving preclearance, they're no longer relevant. We've moved past that. Nobody needs to think about that anymore. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, there are things happening where, you know, the institutions of American society, certainly Supreme Court, certainly the legislatures in a number of states, are kind of saying, you know, the racial, this whole thing about race, it's over. You know, get over it. Everybody's equal. You know, there's nothing to see here, nothing going on here. And if you say there is, then, in fact, you're being racist.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and that actually has been one of the favorite tactics of the right, you know, is to accuse the people who are pointing out the existence of continuing patterns of racial discrimination and said, no, you're the racist. But it's also based on, first of all, defining racism as merely individual acts or instances of prejudice. You know, in other words, that racism is only limited to the malign actions of a few individuals. And so once you define racism that way, you know, basically racism is a behavior that's only engaging by bad people, and most people don't think of themselves as bad people. And so that's part of what the attack is about. It's about denying there is the existence of, that systemic racism exists. That racism is only about the actions of individuals, and only malign individuals. And says, I'm a good person. I can't possibly be a racist. And that's the underlying assumption behind some of the attacks on critical race theory, when they say things like no one should be forced to learn that you are inherently racist. Again, that's getting at this idea that racism is purely about the actions and the malign actions of individuals. You know, and so you know, and so we've seen that in some of the legislation being proposed. I hear it in Louisiana, and that was, you know, that was part of Ray-Gallon-Fowles' bill, is that one provision of it was specifically said that educators would be prohibited from teaching that people are inherently racist because of their membership in a particular racial group. You know, of course, without any showing that this was actually taking place in our schools. So, yeah, I think this is what a lot of this is about.
Let me follow up a little bit on that. So, Louisiana had a law that sought to, you know, somehow institutionalize that critical race theory was wrong. Is this because people have really trouble, or is this a strategy that people have trouble distinguishing between what systemic racism or built into the institutions might be, like, for example, in housing or in distribution of benefits or representation or things like that, and individual actions of racial prejudice or discrimination?
Well, a couple of things. You know, I'll say two quick points. First thing is that I think actually one of the proximate causes for the Louisiana bill, which, by the way, did not get out of committee, thankfully.
Well, nearly shut the legislature down entirely.
Get out of committee, was actually the chair who proposed the bill responding to a particular topic that was of a particular topic from a series that I was actually part of. As a partnership between LSU, Southern, and some other groups, were having a discussion about systemic racism, and partially in response to the George Floyd and the protests that surrounded that. A legislator got a whiff of one of the topics, you know, and basically decided, you know, without basically doing the investigation, that this is a terrible thing and we need to find a way to sort of shut this down. But he tapped into also a larger movement that's actually funded on by deep pocket people on the right. The Heritage Foundation, Heritage Action, has been pushing similar pieces of legislation around the country, and some of them have passed in the past. But again, one of the underlying assumptions behind those things is that there is no such thing as institutional or systemic racism. But that's not really new. That's really been the conservative attack on the civil rights movement, and since 65, is to argue that we've done, you know, America has done a lot of wonderful things in terms of making progress toward racial inequality. And so if there's any remaining inequality, it is the result of the failure of black people to take advantage of all of the progress that has been made. There is no structural basis for this. So there's been a purposeful effort for decades to define racism as merely individualized prejudice, mm-hmm. as prejudice, to deny the existence of systemic racism. And this is just the latest manifestation of that tendency since the 1960s.
Let me jump in just for a second and reintroduce our interlocutors. We are talking to Dr. Theodore Foster of UL Lafayette and Dr. Albert Samuels of Southern University about the issue of critical race theory. Let's bring the 619 Project into this a little bit. So both of you teach, and I imagine that the topic of systematic racism comes up, or slavery or segregation, in some of your classes. What's the relationship between the 1619 Project and critical race theory, or the relationship between Black Lives Matter and critical race theory? Dr. Foster, you want to tackle this?
Yeah, I would say that the ways in which the 1619 Project, critical race theory, have become spectacles for the right to exploit, like objects that black people ultimately, in many ways, created, right? We're talking about Yeah, Derrick Bell at Harvard is often cited as the father of critical race theory, but I would bring up three black women in Patricia Williams, Kimberly Crenshaw, and Cheryl Harris, who are all critical race theorists. They identify as such. Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is the journalist, who is the editor for the 1619 Project, is not a critical race theorist. Neither is Ibram Kendi, the author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, who runs an anti-racist institute at Boston University. He is not a critical race theorist. Neither is Robin DiAngelo, who is a whiteness studies scholar who makes a lot of money on books and diversity training. So I'll just, you know, clarify that a bit for a second. But I would say that, you know, the right seeks to criminalize blackness writ large, and there is a blackness, a certain form of blackness, attached to the demand for reparations, attached to the 1619 Project, and attached to CRT. And they all seek to reform and include black people. Now, there are a lot of other discourses and intellectual trajectories within black history and black politics that do not seek inclusion, whether into the U.S. or the U.K. colonial scheme during the Revolutionary War or during the 70s or today. I think that's what the call for abolition today really reflects, something different than the call to recenter slavery in American history in order to redeem American history, to acknowledge slavery. Abolitionists might say the criminal legal system is irreparable, right? And therefore, we need a new system of situating harm. We shouldn't forget that the Democratic-controlled House had a hearing on reparations 2 years ago that had to center scholars and journalists like Ta-Nehisi Coates detailing the systemic nature of race and racism. So just one other quick thing to backpedal a bit. You know, I don't think we have an adequate understanding of race, much less racism, as Dr. Samuels was just saying. So we need to, you know, read about and define what we mean by race. We know it's not biological. So what the critical and critical race theory is doing is really speaking to a legal, academic, very dry in terms of the writing audience that you aren't going to get critical race theory unless you are in a specific law class. You can go to law school and never learn critical race theory. So what the right very ignorantly is jumping on is the word race and the fact that it's being uttered, which should cause more alarm than even the question of whether racism is systemic or individual. Both need to be worked out. But we need to understand again that there's, you know, there's a real raw material reason behind the creation of the 1619 Project and critical race theory. Two, you know, points would be gendered violence against black women that falls outside of the law, in particular rape, right, and property. Cheryl Harris has a whole essay on whiteness as property published in 1993 that really centers, right, what happened after slavery, what happened after the civil rights movement in the 60s was a kind of evolution of whiteness as property that's under new guises. So here we are, 50-plus years removed from the civil rights gains, and we're still not talking about slavery enough. I know my generation, raised in the 90s and early 2000s, certainly didn't get enough about slavery, much less civil rights. And there are studies that really prove how failing our school system is in that regard. So it trickles all the way up, I would say, to politicians, and not just, you know, Republicans on the right, but plenty of Democrats are, you know, keen to celebrate the victories that have yet to material trickle down to everyday communities, right, that remain in poverty and ignored by the law. So there is a tension there.
You know, I wonder, the conversation about critical race theory and about race in general is so heated that I'm wondering if it's even possible to have a conversation. It sounds like CRT is going to be become radioactive, and then people are going to have to stay away from it entirely, which might be a strategy. But moving on to the idea of teaching, you know, there are laws that are currently passed in five different states, Tennessee, Idaho, Iowa, and Oklahoma, suggesting that teaching the concepts of racial equity and white privilege are illegal now to do so, and teachers can be fired for bringing those concepts up. So What effect are these laws going to have on teaching and in those states and also in Louisiana? Are we looking at a chilling effect?
Well, yeah, they very well could have a chilling effect, you know, because what they also imply, too, is that the state would have to also create some kind of mechanism to enforce those. So presumably school boards or boards, higher education, boards of education, what have you, would have to create some kind of policies essentially to police this. There is a provision that was tucked into a bill in Florida that literally that not only does this, but requires universities to have their to survey their faculty and students, you know, about their political views, and actually gives students the ability to videotape their professors without their consent, and which is all these. So there's some real potential harms to this, some potential repercussions to faculty. You know, these are funnel. And this is one argument that I made when I testified against this law in Louisiana. This is a funnel assault on the principle of academic freedom. There's a frontal assault on the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Specifically, it's a freedom of speech. And it really would require institutions of higher education to put in place policies that could even jeopardize their accreditation. Because one of the core requirements of SAC's accreditation is that we have policies to protect academic freedom, and this would actually cause our accrediting bodies to look at us with an extra degree of scrutiny that we don't really need to have. So there are a lot of harms, and I'll just mention this as a couple of these, and I'm sure Dr. Foster can add some additional ones.
Dr. Foster, we're unfortunately coming right to the end, so something in 30 seconds is, would a law passed like this in Louisiana impede your ability to teach your classes?
I would say no, and, you know, if this is a bellwether for a chilling effect, we might already be in the cooler. If we think about black faculty at UL, if you think about the dearth of curriculum that centers black life, whether in sociology, political science, history, literature, and this is across Louisiana, across the country, across the world, there is a chilling effect, or has been a kind of restructuring and kind of long backlash to the idea that higher education in the U.S. is a liberal bastion. Far to the contrary, higher education has seen a kind of conservatizing effect that I think this is, we should see, you know, the ruptures and what's new about this post-Trump, post-Obama, but we should also be very attentive as a historian, right, to the continuities of the right to exclude, which whiteness upholds, and the demand to be free, which is what black people have been saying, not only to be included. So what is CRT? What is reparations? What is 1619 Project? If not a project to celebrate black Americans, not just black people.
Yeah, can we... That is well said. And let's stop right there. We have been talking today with Dr. Albert Samuels, Dr. Theodore Foster, about critical race theory. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
Support comes from The Vermilion, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette's student-run newspaper, which offers students paid positions. For additional information, contact Matthew Tarver at mtarver@louisiana.edu or call 337-482-6958, 337-482-6958.
KRVS is located on the campus of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find out more at krvs.org. Follow us on Facebook, KRVS Public Media.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.